Fresh Air Community Radio is KFAI FM, Minneapolis, St. Paul. Online and archived at kfai.org. It's where community grows.
From KVMR and in partnership with Freed, this is Disability Wrap.
We want disabled people to feel that their experiences are being embraced, because I think sometimes there might be a tendency for disabled comics to kind of feed into the ableism.
Today, the Comedians with Disabilities Act, who are performing in Grass Valley next month.
And we talk about sex. And I think that's important for us to address and talk about and be able to express ourselves in a way that is natural to us.
That's all coming up on Disability Wrap. Stay tuned. Welcome to Disability Wrap. I'm Lindsay Wells. Today we are joined by Nina G, a comedian who performs with the Comedians with Disabilities Act. She is an author who has written three books, including Once Upon an Accommodation, a book about learning disabilities. And she just recently debuted at number one on two major streaming sites with her solo comedy album, Stutter Interrupted. Nina has been an advocate for people with disabilities for over 20 years. She has been on many talk shows, radio broadcasts, and podcasts. And I have some exciting news. Freed is hosting a fundraiser October 16th at the Center for the Arts in downtown Grass Valley. As I mentioned, Nina is part of a troupe called Comedians with Disabilities Act. They will be performing that night. To purchase tickets to the show, go to Freed's website, freed.org. Comedians with Disabilities Act was founded in 2010 to highlight the comedic styles of comedians who have disabilities. Nina G joined the troupe in 2016. The troupe had toured and performed over 20 shows that bring awareness and laughter to audiences. Well, Nina G, welcome to Disability Wrap.
Hi, thank you so much for having me here.
I want to begin by asking you, what drew you to comedy?
Oh, what drew me to comedy? Everything. When I was a kid, that was kind of the thing that I loved the most. Like, the women I looked up to were people like Gilda Ratner, I don't know if you know her because you're young.
Yes, I do.
Okay. Yeah. So she was one of my idols. I was big on Saturday Night Live. And then just when I was little, that's when Steve Martin became super famous for his stand-up, and I connected there. So it's just something that I've always had since I was like 5 years old. I think having dyslexia and stuttering, I wasn't good in school, especially went to Catholic school in the 1980s. And I always say, you shouldn't pity me for having a disability, but you can't pity me for going to Catholic school in the 1980s with a disability, because that sucked. But even though school didn't feel good, it felt good to know, like, there weren't kids staying up until 1:30 a.m. to watch Late Night with David Letterman to see who the newest stand-up comic was. And I was. And so I kind of felt like I was smarter than everybody else, which kind of culminated during the pandemic. I wrote a book about Bay Area stand-up comedy, a humorous history, it's called. So it's been there my whole life. But when I was 11, I was like, okay, I think I want to do stand up. And that was all through middle school and high school. But I never thought someone who stuttered could be a stand up comic because it was the 80s and I didn't see anybody who sounded like me in comedy, especially a woman. Because at that point, I hadn't even seen a actual woman who stuttered on TV or on the radio or anything like that. So dream dies, picked it back up when I was 35 or 36 in 2010. And been doing it ever since.
That's amazing. You kind of answered my second question, but you mentioned Steve Martin and Gilda Radner, who I adore. So that's amazing. But who else were your favorite people in comedy?
I mean, you know, there's just so many that I could name throughout different phases of my life. When I was in like middle school, early high school, I was all about Emo Phillips. And that was the first person who I wrote a fan letter to. He's very kind of weird and but really talented writer. And he still does it in his now 70s. So loved him. And then, you know, more into the 2000s, people like Chris Rock, who kind of talked about racism. And, you know, like I liked Richard Pryor when I was a kid, and my mom and dad didn't have any filter on what I watched. So my mom brought me to the movie theater to see Richard Pryor live at the Sunset Strip. So I learned all about freebasing and all these things that most 9-year-olds did not know about, but like learning about the world through stand-up was so helpful because I wasn't always able to access the same kind of material as everybody else with my dyslexia, and stand-up was a way for me to understand different issues, different topics like racism. And that's why I really like it, especially as a disabled comic, because that when I went into it, I was like, oh, there's all these Black American comics who are talking about these issues. What if I talked about disability in that same way? So Black comedy had a really big influence on me in that way.
You tour with the Comedians with Disabilities Act. Can I ask you how the group came about?
Yeah, so it actually started even earlier, I think in 2011. And I didn't start it, I joined it. I was lucky enough to join it. It was started by Michael O'Connell, who was from the Sacramento area, and he had MD, and he passed away, I think, in like 16-ish or around there. And that's kind of when I had to take the reins for it to live on, which was really, really hard because it was hard to do stand up and do shows on disability without him because it would make me miss him. But I had friends who are now in the troupe who really encouraged me, like Mean Dave, who's going to be on the Grass Valley show. He really encouraged me to keep it going. At times when I didn't, you know, when I was just like, Michael is gone, I can't. And he really got me to do that. And I think in Michael's name, Michael used a wheelchair, and he, you know, like the thing is that we like people are, it's like, oh, you're such an inspiration because you are disabled. And like once someone told me that and they're like, oh, you're such an inspiration. If I talked like you, I wouldn't talk at all. Like, not a compliment. No, but Michael inspired comedy clubs to get a ramp. And that is the kind of inspiration that I love, is that when people change what they're doing to make it more inclusive and more accessible. So, you know, that's been kind of a core thing that we've done. Like, we won't play a club that doesn't have an accessible bathroom. We have gotten to, we've gotten an accessible bathroom put in at the Elks Club in Butte, Montana. Because we were like, we're not playing you unless we get an accessible bathroom. And I wasn't able to make that show, but I heard that they were drilling in the grab bars right before the show. Like, it was right in the brink of time. We've also gotten that there's a great brewery, Woodhouse Brewery in Santa Cruz, who actually got us a ramp and put up a ramp on their stage so that Jade Terrio could, so that she could perform there. And it's great when we don't have to advocate, when there are clubs like Deaf Puppies and Alameda Comedy Club who already have a ramp. But it's kind of part of our goal that we don't always talk about that isn't on the stage with us. But we want it to be kind of seamless.
Well, you know, that inspiration comment gets me every time. I think I'm like, thank you, but no. Can you know a little bit about your disability and how it impacts your comedic style?
So I have dyslexia and I also stutter. My stuttering is a big part of my act. And it's funny because my dyslexia kind of impacts me more in the world than my stutter, but people don't see it. And I have a hard time kind of bringing that in. I think there's like some emotional barriers to me kind of talking about it and doing jokes about it. So I'm always trying to work it in, but it doesn't always happen. But with the stutter, the world, I mean, anyone with a disability knows this, that the world just gives you punchlines all the time. And like a lot of times I'm like, oh, I just report what happens in my life and that's all I need to do. I would love to really sit down and craft a joke about my stutter, but I don't really need to.
You don't really have to. Oh. I totally get that. And as a person with a disability myself, I come up with some funny anecdotes, but I don't have a comedy show to share that.
Yeah, no, and that is the thing. When I would get like microaggressions before comedy, I would get so upset. Like I would get so mad. Like when that woman told me you're such an inspiration. If I talked like you, I wouldn't talk at all. Like I didn't do a good comeback. I didn't do this. I didn't do that. And so like I would sit in bed and be like, I'm mad. And I made an agreement with myself that I would say something in the moment so that it didn't feel that way when I was in bed. But then starting stand-up, it gave me that opportunity to talk about that stuff. So even if I don't say it in the moment, I eventually say it on stage.
Well, that punchline or that comeback, that in that moment, we don't always think of that, you know? So that's so great that you can do that. Can you tell me one of your favorite jokes that we can share on the radio?
Okay, so I'll do a really easy one, and it's kind of on the topic that we've been talking about, because so many of mine are not PG, so you guys will have to come and check out our shows, especially the one in Grass Valley. Okay, so how many disabled people does it take to screw in a light bulb?
How many?
One to screw it in and five able-bodied people to say, you are such an inspiration.
Yes. That, and not only is that funny, but that's a fact. And with a person with a disability, we get that every day, all day long. So
every day, all day long.
So how does comedy help to explain the disability experience to people without disabilities?
Yeah, well, and I think it's important both to reflect people's experience. So we want disabled people to feel that their experiences are being embraced, because I think sometimes there might be a tendency for disabled comics to kind of feed into the ableism. Mm-hmm. And everybody who performs with us, that is not the case. So they really kind of challenge some of that. And I got such a great compliment the other day. It's why I had a birthday show a week ago. And my friend Enoch was on the show, and Enoch has raging ADHD. And it was the first time that he performed with us. And he said that before he got on, he cried a little bit. And it was because it was the first time he felt that his ADHD wasn't being tolerated, that it was believed, and that it was being embraced and reflected. And so, like, to create an environment where people can feel that, I think is so important. And with that being said, non-disabled people, able-bodied people, whatever you want to call them, they learn part of our experiences in a way that is engaging. And the thing is, we have six core comics who are in the troupe. Each of them has a different disability, a different experience in the world, different sexual orientations, different ethnicities. So I feel like someone may be able to connect with somebody in the lineup. But also, they're all some of the best comics I know. Since I am a comedy snob, you're not going to get anybody who halfway does their comedy.
As a person with a disability, how has the comedy circuit been accepting of you?
Sometimes I think comics think that that my stuttering is a gimmick. And I've heard people say that about other disabled comics. And these are people who are like super famous and they're doing awesome and they're doing great. But they're like, oh, you know, in spite of him being a gimmick, he's actually funny. Like, I heard someone say that about someone who could buy and sell all of us. And that I don't like to hear, because I'm sure they think that of me. And I'm sure that there are some people who think that. There are also others who can kind of see past that and like see my jokes and see the other things I talk about and see that 80% of the time I'm doing really well on stage. 80% of the time I'm doing better than a lot of other comics. And that is what I hope they see. So I think that, you know, I have something more to prove, but there are people, the people who I consistently work with, I really appreciate, because they're just not seeing the stutter. And it's hard, because if I have a 7-minute set at a comedy club, I'm going to talk about stuttering. Like, I have to get people past that point. And so a shorter set, it is harder to prove myself in other ways. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if they think that it's a gimmick, or if they think this or that, screw them. The Comedians with Disabilities Act is doing really well.
And that's good to hear. And you think in 2024 we could move past? I'm excited about our fundraiser on October 16th. And what can we expect at the Comedians with Disabilities event we're hosting in Grass Valley next month?
I mean, I think you guys are going to love it, because it's me, it's Mean Dave, it's Lauren Kraut, and our headliner is Michael Beers, who's coming out just for this from Oklahoma. And he is a disability advocate who's worked for the Center for Independent Living in Montana, in Missoula, for years and years and years and years. And now he's in Oklahoma because he found love and moved there. Yeah, we're just all really good. And I think everyone's going to have a lot of fun. And I think that If you haven't seen us, you have to come in and see us. And that's disabled, non-disabled, everybody.
So I mentioned at the top that you have been an advocate for a long time. Can you explain how you weave your advocacy in with your comedy?
Well, and I think there's with the comedy troupe playing venues that are only accessible, like there's that part, but then there is the advocacy in what we say. And I think a big part of that is talking very truthfully about our disabilities. And I think that is a thread that we all have. And for me personally, I don't talk about my disability in a way that is derogatory toward me. Like, I'll make fun of my nose. I have a good size Italian nose. My mom told me I had a small Italian nose. And I was like, Mom, doesn't really help. And so I will talk about that. I will talk about, you know, like body acceptance of a woman in her, who is now in her 50s. But I will be very careful about my stutter and how I present that, because I don't want people to feel comfortable making fun of it. And last night it was so great because I hosted the show at Deaf Puppies, and like, I hate hosting because I screw up on everybody's name because of my dyslexia. But there was a guy, his name is Travis Nelson. And I kind of said the name like that. But I started to stutter on it, and I had nah. And then I looked around, and then I did nah. And it was a natural stutter. And then I said his name. And like, the audience waited for me to stutter through his name. And I was like, oh, this is what I want. This is how I want the world to be. And I was like, oh, I got this audience to this place. And it just made me so happy to stutter on an N in that way.
So because you have been an advocate, a comedian, say to a young comic that has the dreams that you did early on, what would you tell them while they're just starting out?
You know, I think that they have to develop their own voice. You know, like, I am an advocate, but early on I realized that I would be an advocate whether or not I was a comic. I would be an advocate if I was a scientist. I am so not a scientist, but you know, like, whatever job I would be in, I would be an advocate. Because that's one of those core things in me, but not everyone's like that. And also I think that, you know, it's like Josh Blue. Yeah. He talks about his disability, but I have the sense that he'd much rather talk about weed, you know, and that's cool. And I think part of the freedom is not to have to talk about their disability, but we're not there yet. We are not there yet. Our representation in the media sucks. When is a person with an apparent disability going to have a Netflix special? When is there going to be a showcase of disabled comics? Like, hey, I am ready to go. I got the comics. Talk to me, Netflix, because I am set. When is that going to happen? And that's kind of where we need to go next.
You know, I think you'd be great on Netflix. I'd watch your special.
Well, I do have a special coming out soon. It's going to be on Amazon Prime. And it is self-produced. And my great friend, Gina Chin Davis, was the director. And she also stutters. So this is a collaboration of two stuttering women, which is a very big deal. So it'll be out there, but you know, we had to go through a lot to get there, and we're not backed by the media giants.
That's good to know. Okay, I've got a question for you. How do you think the adult nature of the show works to round out the public perception of people with disabilities? Do you ever get negative feedback from the audience because of that?
So, we talk about adult things and oftentimes in adult language. Yeah. And I think it's really important that what I always say is it's really hard to talk about the disability experience without saying the F word. So the world's given us a lot to use that word, and I kind of feel I'm entitled to it. maybe stop doing all this stuff and I don't have to say it, you know, but until that time comes. And yes, like when we do a corporate event, we of course clean it up. But when I perform, I like to say the things that I want to say. And also, disabled people have sex. And we talk about sex and like there's sex. And I think that's important for us to address and talk about and be able to express ourselves in a way that is natural to us. Now, the thing is, like, in my everyday life, I say the F word all day long. And, you know, I have to, like, you know, I told you, I was influenced by Richard Pryor at a very early age. That is what's going on inside of me. But, you know, I, of course, blunt it at certain times. But it's really nice to come out and speak the way that I want to speak and use the words that I want to use, especially as someone with dyslexia. Words don't always come easy to me. So when I have the right word, I'm very happy to use it, especially if it works with the timing of my joke.
Yes. Okay. So that brings me up to one more follow-up question. I was wondering, Richard Pryor had no filter. And you said you have to clean it up for corporate events. In that moment, do you ever feel like, oh, I want to use that language. I want to get my point across and not have to worry about, you know, what I need to be rated PG. Can you tell me how you come to that conclusion? You're going to, what kind of show you're going to be putting on?
You know, I've been in professional settings where I have to contain myself. And then I can go, like when I used to work at this one place, I would contain myself in a meeting, but then I would go to my boss's office, and my boss, Ned, at the time, he was Italian and Irish and from New York. So I could just let my mouth go and say whatever I wanted to say. And I'm so thankful for that in the workplace. If you pay me enough, I won't say it. Okay. It's basically that. and that is what they get. Sometimes you really want to say it, but time and a place.
Yes. Well, thank you, Nina G. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, guys. I'm so excited for Grass Valley. Oh, my God. It's going to be such a great show.
That was my conversation with Nina G, a comedian with Comedians with Disabilities app. As I mentioned at the top of the show, the Comedians with Disabilities Act will be performing right here in downtown Grass Valley at the Center for the Arts on Wednesday, October 16th at 7 p.m. as a fundraiser for Freed. To purchase tickets to the show, go to Freed's website, freed.org. And that does it for the show. Disability Rappers produced and edited by Carl Sigmund and Courtney Williams. You can go to our website, disabilityrap.org, to listen to past shows, read transcripts, and subscribe to the Disability Rap podcast. You can also subscribe to our podcast by searching Disability Rap on any of the major podcast platforms. We are brought to you by KVMR in partnership with Freed, and we're distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. I'm Lindsay Wells for another edition of Disability Rap.
Programming on KFAI is supported in part by the Bush Foundation, partnering with the Good Relatives Collaborative to announce the 2024 Bush Prize Native Nations Honorees, Minnesota Indian Women's Sexual Assault Coalition, and Lakota Nation Invitational. More information about the honorees and the Bush Prize is online at bushfoundation.org.
Programming on KFAI is supported in part by Health Partners. Minnesotans age 65 plus might qualify for Health Partners Minnesota Senior Health Options. The plan includes personal support, coverage for medical, prescription drugs and dental, plus many extra benefits. Eligibility information is available at healthpartners.com/oneplan. Health Partners is a health plan that contracts with both Medicare and the Minnesota Medical Assistance Medicaid program to provide benefits of both programs to enrollees. Enrollment in Health Partners depends on contract renewal. More information at healthpartners.com/oneplan.
As we age, it's important to invest in our health and to help protect it. Like the flu, COVID-19 is always changing. That's why it's important to stay up to date on your vaccines. By getting the flu and COVID-19 vaccines, you can renew your body's defenses and lower the risk of getting sick. Get your health boost and protect yourself against the flu and COVID. Find vaccines near you at vaccines.gov.
From KVMR and in partnership with Freed, this is Disability Rap.
I thought until I was in college.
I was the only person
like me
who had dreams
of a normal life.
A family, a job, etc.
I thought I'd be the first.
Today, two people with cerebral palsy who found gainful employment, overcame barriers and stigma, and found their passion for life.
I just started seeing the world a little bit differently and moving slower and looking for color. And people thought my photographs were pretty cool.
That's all coming up on Disability Rap. Stay tuned.
Welcome to Disability Rap. I'm Carl Sigmund. With Lindsay Wells.
We're joined today by two working professionals who have cerebral palsy, David Clark and Whittier Mickelson. We're going to talk with David and Whittier about their experiences in the workforce, challenges and misconceptions they've had to confront and overcome about their disabilities, and how their disabilities have helped to shape their lives and careers. David Clark is a computer programmer and systems engineer based in the Boston area. Growing up in Connecticut in the 70s and 80s, David was quickly identified as a candidate for inclusive education at a time when this wasn't the norm. He excelled in school and went on to the University of California, Berkeley, receiving a BA in cognitive science and rhetoric. Through his career, he has built vast experience with online application development and server administration. David currently works as a system designer in the digital research applications team at Mass General Brigham. Whittier Mickelson was an emergency room clinical psychologist. When chronic pain forced her to move away from this career and slow down, she took the opportunity to look deeply within herself and at the natural world. Through this, she reconnected with her passion for photography and art making. Whittier's art has been shown at the Sterling Art Gallery in Dunedin, Florida, the Dunedin Fine Arts Center, the Arts Loft in St. Petersburg, Florida, and at cafes in the St. Petersburg area.
Well, David and Whittier. Welcome to Disability Rap. It is great to have you both with us.
Whittier, this question's for you. I find psychology fascinating. And what drew you to the field of clinical psychology and working in emergency medicine?
That's a little bit of a journey for me. I started out in college as a education major, and I was told by one of the teachers back in the mid-80s that I would not make a good teacher because of my handwriting on the blackboard. So he advised me to go into a different area. And that was kind of crushing for me because my grandmother was a teacher, my mom was a teacher, and I had always thought that I would be a teacher. But he felt that that was not a good idea. So he sort of guided me into psychology. And he didn't really guide me into psychology. I just found that I was taking more psychology classes because I was interested in how the brain works and how we think. And then for about 7 years, I worked in like a halfway house for mentally ill people. And then I went back to graduate school. And at that point, I thought that I would be a counselor, like a one-on-one counselor that sees the same people week after week. But again, I was guided not to do that because of my facial expressions. And I didn't quite know where to go. So I started just applying for jobs. And what worked for me, because I had all of that mental health background, 7 to 10 years, what worked well for me was to be in the ER, where people were very, very much in crisis, and they were more focused on themselves than on me. So, and I like a fast-paced environment. So I did try to be a therapist for a little while. I found it too slow and too, not too boring, but too isolating for me. I'm a very social person. So the ER provided me with the fast pace that I like and the stimulation that I also crave. So it was a really good fit for about 15 years. So, and I did, I climbed the little ladder and I was a supervisor for a number of years doing that. So there were some workarounds that I made. As you know, disabled people are very creative. We have to be. So my boss was amazed that I could do my notes so fast, when in reality, I would talk into my phone and dictate my notes and then email myself and they'd be all typed up. So I discovered workarounds for myself in every job that I've ever held because of dexterity issues, especially with my right side. So
I want to ask a follow-up, Whittier, because you made a point a little earlier on when you were discussing that they guided you to another profession. Can you go into detail what you felt, if you're comfortable telling us, how you felt when you were guided in that other direction, when you had your heart set on education? Can you go into more detail about that?
That discussion was very, very hard for me. And also I had another discussion similar to that when I graduated from grad school with another professor. But the first one where I was guided out of the classroom, so to speak. Now this was before computers, before whiteboards. So my handwriting would have to be up on the blackboard. And I sort of understood where he was coming from. So back then I was shy. I was very shy. And that might have been due to my disability and feeling different and wanting to go where people wanted me to. So I was a little bit more pliable. Now, if that had happened now, I would have probably fought back. Again, this was right after the ADA came out. So it wasn't even, I graduated in the 90, in the year 1990 from college. So there weren't any programs for me, you know, like when I went to grad school, I had a typer, I had a note taker, you know, there were all these programs in places within that 10-year period, 15-year period that weren't there when I was in college. So I think I was a victim of that, you know, that kind of discrimination where they didn't want me in the classroom. They didn't want a disabled teacher teaching. And I didn't realize it back then because I saw myself as everybody else. I didn't really see myself as disabled, even though I've always had CP. I was very active, but it just didn't even occur to me that that would be an issue. So I was kind of floored by that. And again, when I graduated from grad school, my advisor sat me down and said, your facial expressions are going to give you away. You know, to be a really good therapist, you have to really be in control of your demeanor. And she wasn't advising me against it, but she was warning me of the possible implications that my disability might have. God forbid therapists show emotions, right? None of us can hold a poker face very, very well, right? So we tend to wear our emotions on our sleeves, so to speak.
Can I ask a question? Is that okay?
That's okay with me.
Looking back,
how do you feel about the guys?
How do you feel about those guys?
Do you regret listening to them?
Say more about that.
I feel when I look back, I don't hold anger at that because I fell into a career that I loved. So it works out in the long run. So I don't hold a grudge.
Thank you, Whittier. I want to thank you for bringing out those points. I know how important and how meaningful it is for you to talk about it. I know that it can be hard to talk about it because of what you went through. And thank you, David, for asking that question as well. This is a conversation that needs to continue.
I understand.
And I understand. That before you went out to Berkeley, you were mainstreamed in school at a time
when that was relatively uncommon.
How do you think the independent living movement and all the activity in Berkeley helped to pave the way? For your schooling experience.
Yeah.
There is so much to say about that.
My schooling is
unique.
I didn't start
to be mainstreamed
until third grade. And then between third grade and sixth grade. I did some time a week at
public school.
The other part of the week at a special
regional school.
Where I didn't have many
intellectual peers.
There
were other disabled people. But they were not at my intellectual level.
I was the only disabled person in my class. All through junior high and high school.
I was actually not integrated. They took me out of the classroom and put me in a trailer with kids. I was pretty nonverbal, because as you know, spastic CP takes a lot of coordination to talk. And my mother is a speech therapist, so she would work with me, but still I wasn't a talker and my writing was not great. So they had no idea of what was going on upstairs. So they put me in a trailer with the intellectually disabled people who I'm a very small person and they were very big kids. So I spent my spastic years being very scared in a trailer in school. So until I finally told my mom no, in ninth grade, I said, no, this is it. I'm done. And in ninth grade, I wanted to prove myself so badly that I was on the honor roll, integrated into, you know, public mainstream public school. Whereas before, I was in a trailer with a lot of kids that were banging their heads and acting up, and it was quite traumatic to be in school.
I wanted to add
a couple more points. If I could.
One is that because of my experience
in the school system.
I thought until I was in college. I was the only person like me. Who had dreams of a normal life. A family, a job, etc.
I thought I'd be the first.
But I got to Berkeley. And I found out how wrong I was. The other thing that I wanted to say.
As we went out to Berkeley when I was accepted.
I remember vividly someone telling me
that an asshole in a wheelchair
is still an asshole.
And that was such a foreign concept to me.
The point of that is saying
the wheelchair or disability really has no impact on the person.
See, I grew up without needing a wheelchair. So I was mobile. I could run, I could ski, I could hike, I could do all those things up until about 7 years ago. So a CP is just this huge continuum of range of disability. So because we all have CP, it's going to present differently for each of us.
Thank you both. Whittier, I love the story.
How you got back into
about how you got back into photography. And I think it says so much
about the disabled
experience. So can you tell that really briefly? And then we have a final question for both of you.
I didn't go into photography on purpose. I was recovering from my hip replacement 4 years ago, and I found that I was able to walk in the woods, that I would get scared of concrete because of the fear of falling. Now, if I fell in the woods, I'd be okay, right? Because it's a soft landing. But what I found when I was passing people, especially with dogs, they would always say, "You go first." And I'd be scared to go first because they had dogs and they're unpredictable. So I would always ask them to go first. And it was always this constant back and forth, "You go, you go, you go." And then finally, I just started pretending to take photographs. You know, I would just duck into a bush and take a photograph, and then they would go. So I didn't have that back and forth confrontation. And that turned into taking pictures and finding colors in the woods and walking slowly. And from there, I just started seeing the world a little bit differently, and moving slower and looking for color. And people thought my photographs were pretty cool. So I started showing them, and I show all around Tampa Bay now, which is really, it's not a profession, it's more of a fun hobby that I do. So, and it keeps me moving and in the woods. So that's how I came across that.
Thank you, Whittier. We want to ask one final question, the both of you. David, first I'll ask you, and then Whittier, can you follow up with the question? What would you tell others with disabilities who are considering joining the workforce, but are concerned about how that could impact their daily lives or even their financial situation? David, can we start with you?
Yeah.
I'm afraid it really depends
on the state you live in.
I'm very lucky that I live in Massachusetts.
Because
they have a program
where you can buy into
Medicaid.
So your premium is determined.
By your income.
But they give you durable medical.
PCAs.
All kinds of common Medicaid coverage. That you would never get
from private insurance.
Unfortunately, I don't think every state offers.
Unfortunately, I don't think every state offers such a wonderful program.
And Whittier, can we have your thoughts about the same question?
So I'm going to answer it right now. I'm on SSDI, and I don't think that I could be accountable to work because of my pain level. But back when I was working and back when I was interviewing, I think it's important for people to know that they can ask for accommodations. Like my job, there was this one time when my job changed a little bit, and emergency services clinicians were going to homes, which I think they do now, and ERs. Now, for me to go into a home is dangerous. I don't know if there's a hand railing. I don't know how psychotic the person is that I'm interviewing. I don't know if I'll have to run. There were so many ifs in my brain that I just was not comfortable doing home visits by myself. So I went to my boss after thinking about it, and she understood, and she made the